Hi, I'm Jay Sherbrooke, DO, family physician and diabetologist, and a professor at Touro University, California. We're continuing our series on everyday diabetes, practical management strategies for primary care. Today, I'm delighted that we have Dr. Tyree Winters with us. He's an osteopathic physician and a board-certified pediatrician with extensive clinical experience in pediatric weight management and adolescent medicine. He's the Associate Program Director at the Pediatric Residency at the Gorib Children's Hospital and Medical Center at the Health Start Clinic in Morristown, New Jersey. Welcome, Dr. Winters. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So our topic today is type 2 diabetes in children and adolescents. And I have to tell you, when I was in training, that was not something I thought of. I actually thought of juvenile diabetes type 1 and adult diabetes type 2. What's the story with type 2 diabetes in kids?
So that's a great question. Up until about 1990s, around 94, you would only see about maybe 4% of children who would have type 2 diabetes. And so it did make sense for up until around the 90s where you would assume that if a child had diabetes, it would be more type 1, and the reason why we refer to it as juvenile diabetes. However, when around the 90s, we started seeing an increase in the incidence of obesity rates in children, and in addition to the increase in the obesity rates, we wound up starting to see an increased prevalence of type 2 diabetes around that time as well. And so now, unfortunately, there has been almost triple the amount of children who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And so calling it type 1 juvenile diabetes now is unfortunately incorrect because of the fact that we're seeing a higher increase of type 2 diabetes.
How is type 2 diabetes different in children than it would be in adults?
Interesting question. So the difference between children having type 2 diabetes as well as adults, the pathophysiology is pretty similar in the sense that there is the hallmark insulin resistance, as well as you see a decrease in insulin production in the body. And around 80% of children who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes you will note that you would have decrease in 80% of the beta isolate cells around the time of diagnosis for type 2 diabetes side. So what wound up happening is that you also have a different process that's going on in the body at this time, which is puberty. So around the age of 10, you would notice that children have a physiologic insulin resistance already. And so in addition to obesity being something that is very common within children who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, it's actually one of the most common comorbid conditions that you see, you will see that there's already a setup for insulin resistance, plus with having the fact that the body naturally is physiologically less sensitive to insulin based off of the start of puberty. As well as around the age of 14 to 19, you see that the increase in growth hormone will lead to insulin resistance as well. And so with all of those factors aligning together, that's the reason why children have a greater chance, especially if they're obese, to have type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those are really important points. So I think the physiology is really set up, which is so wonderful for growth and development, but horrible when you have insulin resistance.
Exactly.
And then you stack on top of that, that they're adolescents who have free will, and giving them a chronic disease makes it so hard. And, you know, my experience has been quite hard to treat adolescents with type 2. What are your suggestions?
So there's a couple of suggestions. The first one is making sure that we educate our patients. As an adolescent, even at the age of 10, the thought process of children has changed at this point in time. It's less concrete thinking, more abstract thinking. At this point in time, the children are starting to understand the ramifications of having a diagnosis. And I mean, it's been studied quite well that actually teenagers at this point in time have very close reasoning and thought process as an adult. So The first thing is education, making sure that our patients understand, because it is a very devastating diagnosis to give when you don't understand. The next thing is, in addition to educating about the diagnosis, educating about the treatment options and plans. One of the main focal points of treatment for type 2 diabetes, along with pharmacological therapy, is lifestyle modification. And so having an intensive lifestyle modification program that they undergo, whether that's through the primary care doc, or even if we look at more stage 3, stage 4 weight management programs, which is more multidisciplinary programs, that you can see there is an effect to be able to help these children along the way.
So it sounds like it's a serious condition. You need to put full court press for the child and for the family if we're going to really focus on lifestyle, right?
I think correct.
That's important. Who should we be screening for? It seems to me that everybody is overweight or obese now. So should I be screening everybody? What guidance do you have?
So there's actually guidelines that are set by the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the Endocrine Society and the Pediatric Endocrine Society, which is, one, we want to look at children that are higher risk for type 2 diabetes, because obviously we can't just screen everyone. So these type of criteria that we normally would like to see is that, one, the children would have a BMI greater than the 85th percentile, in addition to having either a first-generation family member that has the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, as well as or other comorbid conditions. So these are the kids that we may notice who have hypertension, essential hypertension, that we're now seeing even more prevalence of in these adolescents and younger children. If they come from a more at-risk background or group, a cultural group, so African Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans have a higher propensity, Asian Americans as well. The other risk factor that you want to look for is if they were small for gestational age, or if their mothers had gestational diabetes while they were pregnant with them. So that's where, especially as a pediatrician, I'm very used to still taking a very thorough history, especially birth history, even for my teenagers, because I want to be able to understand what could possibly be some of those risk factors that can later play a role, even though after around the age of 3 or 4, we tend to stop asking as much about that gestational history.
So we should be looking for our kids who are overweight, our kids who are at high risk for type 2 diabetes. In fact, their families are at high risk for type 2 diabetes.
Exactly.
And then if we find people, can we screen the same way? Do we screen with glucose testing? Or?
So actually, there has been some evidence. It used to be a time where we didn't use hemoglobin A1Cs in children. And this has recently changed, where it's becoming more involved now. To be able to use that as a diagnostic tool and as a screening tool. However, we always have to be careful for several reasons with hemoglobin A1Cs. We can have some false positives that can come about. Also remembering, too, for these groups that I just made mention of, African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, they also have blood dyscrasias that we have to be considered as well that can affect the hemoglobin A1Cs, such as sickle cell anemia and thalassemias, etc. But in addition to that, we also want to be able to screen using either hemoglobin A1C, a fasting blood glucose level. We can also look at an oral glucose tolerance test. The thing is that if the hemoglobin A1C and the fasting blood glucose or plasma glucose is considered to be within the pre-diabetes range, then we can't necessarily rule out that these children don't have type 2 diabetes. We need to do further tests along the way, because a lot of times these tests may show that it's only prediabetes, when most likely there could be, we're catching them at a very early stage. That's where the oral glucose tolerance test comes into play. That's more of a reliable test that we can be able to use for that diagnosis. If the oral glucose tolerance test shows that the child has prediabetes, then we can now at this point in time, be more aggressive with the weight management, which we hope to do anyway before this, but being more aggressive and then making sure that we are testing them more regularly. So there are some recommendations to test every 3 years, but I must say in my own practice, especially dealing with weight management, I usually test these children every year just to make sure that I'm catching them in case there's a possibility that they were really earlier on started. Because even though we can maybe prolong the diagnosis, unfortunately for some children, they will still later on develop type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. So what I heard you say today is we need to have a higher index of suspicion to be looking for at-risk kids for prediabetes and type 2. It is more common than we used to think of, and we need to really use the right terminology. We can use the same screening tests, but remember that we do have to, there are limitations to the hemoglobin A1C, and yes, that we need to kind of know their background hematology, and that the best test to diagnose diabetes is still the glucose tolerance test in children. And then remember, a family-based lifestyle intervention is the mainstay of treatment of type 2 diabetes in adolescents. And there are some medications, but they're much less than there are in adults. So really important points. Dr. Winters, we're so glad you were here today. Thank you for sharing these great insights.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.